Welcome to Northern Soundings, Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. With COVID-19 claiming lives and challenging our communities and economy, to cope, many are turning to mindfulness apps on their phones and devices or participating in online yoga classes. Jeff Kitsis, a Zen master who frequently visits Fairbanks, says meditation can also be a way of challenging our assumptions.
Mindfulness and much of psychology is a little bit more in supporting the self, but it's still different than deconstructing the self to see what's organic and alive underneath the self concepts.
Also on the show, author and reviewer Frank Sos is in with some recommended readings to keep the baseball spark alive.
Most people have set baseball aside except maybe for a couple games during the World Series. So these books might revive people's interest in this game.
And Chris Lott is in with a transcendental term or two on cachexic clippings. I hope you'll join us. Back in February, before travel restrictions and social distancing was set in place, Jeff Kitsis was in Fairbanks. Jeff is a psychotherapist from California and frequently leads Zen retreats in town through the Cold Mountain Zen Center. Jeff is also a certified Zen master whose Buddhist name is Bonsong. He heads up the Empty Gate Zen Center in Berkeley. While he was in Fairbanks this last time, he was invited to talk with University of Alaska Fairbanks students, faculty, and staff at a new room called The Well, intended as a quiet and inviting spot where students and others can soothe and replenish their spirits through meditation or other contemplative practices. When I talked with Jeff, I began by asking about his background and whether his parents were into meditation.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York. My parents were definitely not interested in Buddhism, although I remember a Buddha in the house, but I think it was just ornamentation. If you go by my age, I'm 66 years old, so I was 15 in 1968. So for those people who are old enough to remember that, I like to say the world was on fire, and I was caught up in the heat of that. I grew up in a Jewish family, but we were not religious. I mean, I went to Hebrew school, I got bar mitzvah, but my parents were definitely not religious. As it turns out, I found out much later, I come from a very long line of rabbis.
Do you really?
Yes, and actually it's just a fun fact. The rabbi who is the founder of the Hasidic sect, his right-hand man was a Reb Wolf Kitsis. So the family all stems from that rabbi.
Wow.
And he's actually buried right next to the Baal Shem Tov.
Well, now, do you think you were predisposed to be a teacher?
Probably not, although because my grandfather broke the line. My grandfather emigrated here after World War I from Ukraine. And he was actually a communist and very anti-religion. So I don't know much about his father, but either his father or his grandfather was the last in the line of rabbis. And then my father grew up being totally non-religious. My family was not spiritual at all. But in the late 60s, especially, I was in youth groups, and we started doing things like sensitivity groups and tea groups, and it was the first time I started learning that there was something other than the material world.
Oh, interesting.
So it kindled my spiritual sense.
When do you first recall hearing about Buddhism or Zen or in that broadening?
Well, when I trace it back, when I was 14 years old, I went into Greenwich Village in New York City with a friend. And we bought a meditation candle. And we went back to his apartment in Brooklyn. I was already living out on Long Island. And we lit the candle and we meditated. And when I think about it, I don't know why I would have known about it. Lately, I think it must have been the Beatles and transcendental meditation and the whole thing that the Beatles brought up. You know, it's funny, when I was in fifth grade when the Beatles came to the United States, and the next day everybody was deciding which Beatle they were, and I was George Harrison. So it was perfectly fitting. I followed that path. I didn't even know why at the time.
Yeah. Describe your path a little bit.
So I went to college because I had to, not because I wanted to. And it was really in college, and I have to admit, through dabbling in some drug experiences, I got deeper and deeper into a sense of that there was something other than the path that I had seen set out for me. Up until college, it was more political. But once I got to college, I started just getting feelings of something different. I got formal training in transcendental meditation. I started to meditate. And through some other experiences, I just decided, I knew I didn't want to become a lawyer or something like that. And I didn't know what I wanted. So when I was in college, I started reading the books, The Teachings of Don Juan by Carlos Castaneda.
Sure.
And I was really moved by that, especially his third book is called Journey to Ixtlan. And the first two books was a lot about drug experiences and spirituality. But the third book pulled all the drug experiences out of it. And it was basically a manual for how to live your life in a spiritual way. And I was really moved by it. So in my youthful mentality, my friend and I were going to go to the desert in northern Mexico and find him. As it turned out, it took us about a year to go on our journey. And in the meantime, my friend fell in love. So we started our journey together. But after 2 or 3 days, he was so miserable that he decided he had to go back to who is now his wife. And we knew somebody in California. So we continued on to California instead of Mexico. And then from things somebody had told me before I left on my journey, I knew about this small town called Mendocino, California. It's kind of an artist colony, crafty-like town, which in those days was a little hippie town. And I ended up on a little Zen community. And that's how I started practicing Zen.
Now, I'm going to shift gears just a little bit because Empty Gate Zen Center is in Berkeley. And it was started around 76, 77?
Yes, before I got there.
But not long after it began, you went on retreat or session.
Correct.
With Sung San.
Zen Master Sung San, yes.
Yes. And so that wasn't too long after it was established. What was it about him that did you know right away, this guy's the real deal?
I was attracted to Zen Master Sung San's energy. He was a very dynamic, alive person. So his teaching style and the language that he used did speak to me. I had already been practicing more Japanese style. Zen Master Sung San came from Korea. So culturally, it was very different. And I had sat with a couple of different Zen masters and had good experiences with them. In some ways, it was just a good place for me because it's a long story, but moving to Berkeley fit where I was at that time. And I sat a retreat with him, and I just moved into the Zen Center afterward, after the retreat ended. And I probably at that time didn't know that I was going to stay for as long as I have. But he was a very alive person. And being with him, it always felt a little surrealistic. Life was very funny. He laughed a lot. One of the monks who would travel with him, he would say, with Zen Master Sung San, every day is a big day. Everything you're doing with him is alive. It's almost pulsating with energy. And I was really attracted to that. And even now, I see at the base of Zen, it's about being alive. It's about presence. It's about engagement and fully entering into whatever situation I'm in. So he embodied that.
And he was amazingly productive in the sense that he started something like 100 different Zen centers. Is that right?
Yeah, we probably have I guess it's close to 100 around the world. I don't really know. We probably have 20 or 25 just in the United States alone. All of the centers tend to be small, or most of them. In Asia, it's different. In Asia, we could get to that, but there's a Chinese diaspora in Asia who, it's turned out, our style of practice has really spoken to. There are temples in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, those are the main ones that I could think of, where Chinese monks and nuns have been gravitating towards our style because this is the way I see it, it offers the people in the temple a practice. Our practice is very accessible. We do meditation, we do chanting. The language of the teaching is very oriented towards everyday life. And there has been a real open reception to that style in these temples in Asia. So some of those temples are very large. But in the United States, many of our groups are 15, 20 people, 25 people. We have a couple of larger ones. But there's a lot of smaller ones scattered throughout the United States, all over Eastern and Western Europe, and Korea and Asia.
That's Zen Master Bon Song, who was in Fairbanks several months ago. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation. This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Welcome back. Let's continue with my conversation with psychotherapist Jeff Kitsis, whose Buddhist name is Bon Song. He's also a Zen master in a Korean lineage. Well, since you have been practicing and now leading communities in this tradition for so long, how have you seen Zen change over the years?
I can't vouch for the accuracy of what I'm about to say, but it's my impression. To give it a time frame, I first went to Empty Gate in 1979. I started teaching in the early 90s. And what I noticed, I started going to conferences with other teachers and other traditions. There seemed around the early to mid 90s a shift from some vague sense of personal enlightenment to a more of a sense of wisdom and compassion. I think compassion and action in a way that brings healing to the world and to people has become a little bit more in the forefront than some vague abstract idea of enlightenment. And I think that has been actually quite a big change.
You know, when I think about the early days of Zen and Eastern groups and ideas coming into the West, because I'm roughly contemporary mm-hmm. with you, there was this wonderful energy, as you talk about, everybody was so excited and these groups sprang up. But lately there have been scandals that have rocked some groups and teachers who inappropriately behave and sometimes compromise their students and their organization. One of the challenges must be how to adapt something that grew up in a different culture entirely so it works in American culture.
Yes.
I mean, is this an ongoing issue?
To think in our group, we've gotten beyond it. We have had to deal with it. In the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s, it was the early time, and Eastern and Western culture isn't exactly the same. And the thing about Zen, I think it's taken a while for ethics and morality to work its way up to the surface. We've always taken precepts, but from the early days, the line in a precept ceremony was, know when to keep them, know when to break them, know when they're open, know when they're closed. Even in Japan and Korea, there have always been iconoclastic Zen masters. And as I've read, there were some Zen masters who ran temples, and there were some who were wild and just lived on their own, more like hermits or even part of society. And they worked by different rules. One of my friends once said that where in America, we come from a puritanical background, they didn't have that in Asia. So even though they're somewhat conservative, there's more room than we actually have in this country. So I think when the Asian teachers came to this country, they didn't have a tight view of morality. I'm not saying it all that well, but I'm hoping you're understanding what I mean. And they met the libertine 60s and 70s in this country. So a lot of the teachers got swept up into that. And sometimes they joke they were a little bit like kids in a candy store. So it took a while it wasn't until I would say the early 90s again, where some of these ethical breaches started coming out. I have to say, I started practicing in the mid-1970s, and I knew about a lot of these ethical problems that haven't come out until just even the last few years. So things have been going on all along. The fact that they're out now is just that our society has changed.
Mm-hmm. And I think other traditions, other faith paths have had their share of these things too.
Yes.
It's a human nature.
Exactly. It's not confined to spirituality. I think in the spiritual world, whether it's the Catholic Church or synagogues or the Buddhist world, in a way, it's my opinion that it's even more dangerous. Because what I've learned as a teacher is people bring their deepest wounds and their deepest aspirations to a teacher. So when a spiritual teacher abuses their position to satisfy their own desires at the expense of the person who is so vulnerable, it's that much worse.
Well, that's a wonderful segue to another branch of questions I want to ask you, because you're a psychotherapist. And I wonder, was it your practice that ultimately led you to your other practice of psychotherapy?
Yeah, in my case, it actually was. When I went to California, I was looking for a new life. So I grew up in something of an intellectual family. I joke that my father would get frustrated just rolling up an extension cord. He had no manual skills. So because I was looking for a different life, I decided to go the more manual labor route. And I became a carpenter. And I did that for about 8 or 9 years before I finally stopped. I was never great. I was good enough. And it pushed me into areas that I was completely unskilled in. You know, the base point of our Zen practice is not knowing. And by entering into carpentry, I was completely ignorant. So I was completely open. So I learned a lot about myself. I grew up a lot in my 20s doing that kind of work. But as I started looking for other work, people started telling me, oh, you know, you'd be a good therapist. I always had a way of listening to people and I suppose empathy and compassion. So when I was looking for something else, my idea was, well, I could become a psychotherapist and I can help bring Zen out of the Zen Center into the world. And one of the things I did right away is I started doing 5 minutes of meditation with all of my clients, or most of my clients. And really, Buddhism, I would say, is my theoretical orientation. The Buddhist teachings about human suffering, the origins of suffering, how mind gets confused and distorted. I don't come from a model of pathology. I come from a model, I suppose, for psychotherapists or in psychology, people might remember Carl Rogers, whose main point was unconditional positive regard, with a belief that if you give a person enough space, their own inherent wisdom and compassion will emerge. So if you switch it to a Buddhist context, it's as if anybody I'm working with is the Buddha. And I can see them in that way and work with them in that way. So the psychological and the spiritual just easily join hands together.
You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm talking this segment with Zen master and psychotherapist Jeff Kitsis. He's also been leading retreats in Fairbanks for years through the Cold Mountain Zen Center. We'll continue our conversation after this break. Welcome back. I'm Robert Hannon, and I'm talking with psychotherapist and Zen master Jeff Kitsis, whose Buddhist name is Bonsong. Let's get back to our conversation. You know, it's often been observed that Buddha was more like a physician in the sense that he diagnosed an illness or proclivity to suffer and then wrote a prescription, a remedy, which is the Four Noble Truths. And he's more like a physician than he is a religious figure.
Right. In some ways, Buddhism is less a religion and more a life practice. Basically, in Buddhism, you're turning your gaze inward and you're doing exploration on yourself. When I was doing a master's thesis on psychotherapy and Zen, I came across a Japanese writer who said, the study of human beings is the study of philosophy. The study of myself is Zen. So rather than looking outward and understanding what you see outside of yourself, you turn your gaze inward and you begin to watch mind, heart, and body, and from that you start to understand the nature of yourself, and then by extension the nature of all humans.
You know, after the 70s, you know, a lot of hippies became stockbrokers and lawyers and entered into the mainstream, and in a similar way it seems the spiritual insights from Buddhism and yoga, etc., have kind of matured, and now it's so interesting to hear mindfulness as a buzzword because there are apps off for phones and tablets, and mindfulness has become a huge issue. From your perspective, both as a psychotherapist and a Zen master, how do you see this?
Well, I think any self-exploration is a good thing. So the fact that mindfulness has become so mainstream is all to the good. It's not exactly Buddhist practice, though. If I had a critique, and I'm sure Jon Kabat-Zinn and some of the others who really originated. Now, Jon Kabat-Zinn was a student of Zen Master Sung San's for a while. He kind of moved off a bit to the Vipassana groupings. But Buddhism is about deconstructing the self. The practice is about asking the question, what am I? Or maybe even better said, what is this thing that we call I? You know, we'll say, I want fill in the blank. Sometimes it's helpful to put it in the third person. I wants to drink. I wants love. So you start to see that self is something of a mental construct. And Buddhism is about deconstructing that construct and seeing what's underneath. It's a little unfair to mindfulness, perhaps, but mindfulness and much of psychology is a little bit more in supporting the self and making the self happier, making the self many different things. But it's still a little bit different than deconstructing the self to see what's organic and alive underneath the self concepts.
You know, interesting, there was a recent book a couple of years ago, Why Buddhism is True, by Robert Wright, and he kind of lays it out there that one of the most famous and perhaps controversial tenets of Buddhism is there is no self. Mm-hmm. And he was pointing out that modern neuroscience is kind of coming to the same conclusion.
Right. Although I have to correct, I don't know if it's him or you, but it's not that there's no self, there's no permanent abiding self. Self.
That's probably me. I'm sure he made that distinction.
Right. Self arises. We need a self in order to interact in our world. But if we believe it's permanent, then we're missing the point. That the self arises out of conditions, and once the conditions change, the self changes, if we let it. A lot of mental illness and mental struggle is actually about having too rigid a self. So we try to apply the same solutions to different problems. Buddhism actually is teaching a kind of fluidity and ability to move with the changing circumstances and not to stay stuck in our way of thinking. And I would go as far as to say the more trauma that we experience, the more rigid we become as a way of protecting. And that rigidity actually is the source of much of the struggles with mental illness that we find. That the more flexible and adaptable and resilient we are, the more free we are, and actually the more joy and love and compassion is available to us.
That's Zen master and psychotherapist Jeff Kitsis. He was in Fairbanks in February, leading a retreat through the Cold Mountain Zen Center. We'll hear more following this break. This is Northern Soundings. Welcome back to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. I'm talking this segment with psychotherapist and Zen master Jeff Kitsis. He's led many retreats in Fairbanks over the years through the Cold Mountain Zen Center. His own center is in Berkeley, California. Let's get back to our conversation. It's interesting that the University of Alaska Fairbanks has developed what it calls the Well, and it's a space set aside not to study, but to meditate. And that must be, you recently spoke there and you've been coming up to Fairbanks a long time, but that must be an encouraging development.
Yeah. And those kinds of developments are everywhere. I was walking through the airport on my way up here and there was a sign for a yoga room at the airport. And there's always been prayer rooms and meditation rooms, but all of this is becoming more part of our culture. Buddhism first came to the United States, we trace it back to the late 1890s.
And is that the World Parliament
of
Religions?
Yes, that's exactly it. And it began to be practiced here at that point. And we have our own, the Transcendentalists in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. So we still think of Buddhism as a foreign thing, but actually it's quite homegrown right now.
Do you think your style will evolve and change at all?
That's a good question. There's a tension. On one hand, there's a desire to modernize, to take the forms and make them more accessible. But there's also a feeling of needing to maintain some of the forms so that you create a container that people can do their Buddhist practice in. So we have discussions all the time. Should we get rid of our robes? Should all the chanting be in English now? And there are people on all sides of that issue.
I'm sure. But I guess that discussion is, again, the aliveness. It keeps the issue up there, and you have to think about it, right? Yeah. Okay, well, I want to talk about a couple of things, because you mentioned earlier, and I'm right there with you, some experiments when we were young with psychedelics is now coming back again, and they're using these as ways to help people who are end of life or in hospice come to terms with death and with depression and other issues. Is that a promising sign? And it seems to me the way you're describing it, meditation would be a perfect complement to that.
Yes. I'm generally skeptical. I actually think it's a good thing that things are churning in this way. You know, my perspective on this comes a little bit as a psychotherapist. After Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics came out, I have more and more, especially my younger clients, wanting to engage in some exploration using what now they call medicines. You know, all the language is changing. And there is seemingly much more openness in our society for it. There seem to be groups of people who are helping people do these kind of experiences in a formal way. A lot of my clients are searching out guides and looking for one-on-one experiences in a very contained and therapeutic setting. And it seems to me for those who have done it, they have good experiences. But I look back in those early years, and I know that many, many, many people have used psychedelics, and they don't necessarily change everything. So I think all of these things are good and helpful, but I'm often careful on the promise of them. Even something like, well, even Buddhist practice. I've been around Buddhist centers long enough to know that it's helpful, but it's not the end all. People need lots of different things. I think the psychological perspective is really valuable in addition to a Buddhist practice. I think that would be true for psychedelic practices. Our self-concept is very stubborn and very rigid, and it takes a lot of different things. And most important, it takes a daily practice. You can't do these things once or twice and imagine that it's going to transform your life. You have to, every day, you almost have to have a mindset of inquiry and questioning. What is this? Wherever you are, what's going on right now? Not just what I believe, but to try to dig down below my beliefs and see things more clearly. And that takes work. Our point of view is very rigid, and it takes a lot of work to be able to get out from behind that.
Mm. Well, I guess the final big E question, enlightenment, that's often held up. And for some peoples, it's something of a myth. There is no real enlightenment. For other people, yeah, we're all enlightened. I mean, there's a certain literature that suggests we're all born enlightened. So how important is it for your practice in school, and where should we put this idea of enlightenment in the broader cultural context?
See, the problem is, is enlightenment as an idea. There is something to it experientially. But I've read a quote, it's like, enlightenment is not what you think. There's a song by Van Morrison called Enlightenment. In the first few lines of the song, it goes, enlightenment, don't know what it is. But I think if you accent that a little bit differently, enlightenment, don't know, is what it is. In other words, we're moving from the protection of knowing to the open vulnerability of not knowing. Enlightenment isn't a thing. It's an open, alive state. Anything can happen. Back in the late 70s, I remember Zen Master Sung San saying, it was the early days of doing neuroscientific testing on Zen masters or meditation masters. And he refused. He said, well, if they see I'm angry, they won't know why I'm angry. If you have an idea that an enlightened person never gets angry, well, then it's just your idea. In Zen, we ask, why do that? Everybody knows that sometimes anger is a very important tool. Why give up tools when you need anger sometime? If your child is running across the road, you're angry and you yell and that child stops. So anger itself is not good or bad. Practice is not about attaining any particular state. It's an open, fluid, wise, and compassionate state from which you respond to conditions as they arise. So enlightenment isn't a thing, it's a way of being. And my teacher used to say, enlightenment is easy to get, hard to keep. Everybody has moments where our thinking mind falls away. Maybe you're looking at a beautiful sunset, or maybe you're watching a movie that fully enthralls you. Then there's no self. There's the movie and you become one. But as soon as the movie's over, you go back to your ignorant self. So practice means plowing the field so that the ground is fertile and ready to appear as the moment arises.
I'm talking right now with psychotherapist Jeff Kitsis, and he's also Zen Master Bonsong. Comes up periodically here in Fairbanks, teaching through the Cold Mountain Zen Center. And he is the master down in Berkeley of the Empty Gate Zen Center. Thank you so much for talking with me.
It's my pleasure.
Links to the Cold Mountain Zen Center in Fairbanks, UAF's The Well, and Berkeley's Empty Gate Zen Center are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, some books to ease the absence of baseball spring training. The rituals for some diehard baseball fans is to head to Florida's baseball camps to take in spring training. That option was called on account of COVID-19. Author and reviewer Frank So sympathizes, and he's in with some recommendations to ease the pain.
First off, as everyone knows, the Baseball Hall of Fame at Cooperstown was founded on a falsehood. No more than little George Washington said to his father, "Dad, it is I," etc. did Major Abner Doubleday invent the game of baseball on that sacred spot? The only thing Major Doubleday started was the Civil War, when he answered the Confederate Beauregard by firing the first shot from Fort Sumter. Yet, to this day, shouts such heresy in the bleachers at a Sunday doubleheader, and not only will there be 3 out of 4 patrons call you crazy, but some self-styled authority on the subject, probably a dad with his boy, I know the type, will threaten you for saying something so awful in front of innocent kids. That's a quote from the great American novel by Philip Roth. Came out in 1972, which was a very good year for writing about baseball, as it turns out.
And, of course, we're looking at books that celebrate the game because we can't watch games now, can we?
That's right. And so if people are looking for a baseball fix, we can offer a number of books, fiction and nonfiction, and many of them celebrate that classical era in baseball when people my age were kids.
It's called The American Pastime, so it's so linked to our country, but it's really an arcane game. There's a lot going on underneath the surface, isn't there?
Well, there is, and to go back to the American pastime, it's that baseball's pretty much been superseded, I'm afraid. I mean, there are people who love baseball. I know there are people in Fairbanks who still would go to spring training if they could, but most people have set baseball aside except maybe for a couple games during the World Series. So these books might also revive people's interest in this game, which is more tranquil, and it does take more time to watch or listen to a baseball game on the radio as people used to do. But I think it's worth remembering that baseball is a wonderful game, and it is a much nuanced game too.
What writers, Frank, do you think have successfully tackled this subject?
Let's go back to The Great American Novel, which is a book by Philip Roth that's not widely read, and the narrator is a guy who calls himself Word Smith, world's greatest sports writer, and he's come to tell us a story about a horrific scandal that we all need to be aware of, which is that there were once 3 major baseball leagues, the third one being the Patriot League. And the Patriot League has been expunged from our collective memory, and of course the Baseball Hall of Fame, because it was infiltrated by communists. Their star pitcher, Gilgamesh, known as Kid Babylonia, is one of the central figures in this book, but it's a sprawling novel about baseball gone haywire, actually. All made-up teams, all made-up players in this case, based on a strange, interesting Cold War premise, too.
One of the wonderful things about baseball is the smell of the grass, the beer, the raucous crowd and whatnot.
Well, if you want to do the texture of baseball, let's talk about a couple of nonfiction books. One of them is, of course, The Boys of Summer, which also came out in 1972 by Roger Kahn. Roger Kahn died in February now. The Boys of Summer is his pay-on to the old Brooklyn Dodgers, the Bums. And it's about the 1952 season. Once again, the Dodgers are close, but no cigar in winning World Series. In 1951, they have famously lost a 3-game playoff to their crosstown rivals, the Giants, on the famous shot heard around the world, Bobby Thompson's home run. And we pretty much now are sure that the Giants were stealing the Dodgers' signals from the catcher by stationing a guy in the scoreboard in the outfield with a pair of binoculars looking at the catcher's signals. So Bobby Thompson may have known what pitch was coming to him. However, the season of 52 is another not quite successful season, but the Dodgers were an amazing team then. We're talking about Pee Wee Reese, Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, Gil Hodges, great players, and of course, they and the Giants soon enough would move to the West Coast, and the Dodgers would stop being the Bums and start being an L.A. glamour baseball team, which is what happens to sports when they get to Los Angeles, it seems. So there's that book. And simultaneous to that is a book by another Roger that's also very good on just the nitty-gritty texture of baseball. That's The Summer Game by Roger Angel. Roger Angel wrote 5 collections of baseball pieces. They all originally appeared in The New Yorker, and he was The New Yorker's baseball writer for many, many years. Roger Angel will turn 100 later this year. A little frail, but a great chronicler and lover of the texture of baseball. So you start with The Summer Game, and you follow it up with 4 more volumes of Roger Angel's writing about baseball. So those are nonfiction ones, Robert.
That's Frank Sos recommending some books to satisfy those suffering from baseball withdrawals. We'll hear about other titles after the break. This is Northern Soundings. Welcome back. Frank Sos is in with some titles for those pining for America's pastime. Let's return to his suggestions.
Let's get one more oldie book out there. And one of the interesting things about Roth is the kind of loaded external meaning weight into these baseball stories, questions of ethics and morality and so forth. And maybe the champion of that is the Universal Baseball Association, J. Henry Wall, Proprietor, by Robert Coover. And this is a book that predicated on a guy inventing a very complicated board game played with dice that is an imaginary baseball game. Back in the days before video games, this is how you imagined baseball. So J. Henry Wall has developed this vast, complicated league of players and games and schedules. And it is consuming his life to get all his schedule played. But one night, he rolls his dice, and through a series of rolls, multiple sixes, he comes up with, on his very elaborate charts of what all these dice rolls mean, batter hit by pitched ball and dies. Now, at this point, readers might think, well, the initials, J.H.W., everybody with a theological bent will recognize this guy, right? We're talking about Yahweh here, and he has suddenly introduced sin and error into his own creation. So at this point, the baseball novel becomes freighted with questions, the biggest questions of the nature of evil in our world. So there you go. If you want to zero in to some things closer to ground level, and 2 relatively new books. One of them is 2011, The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. People who follow baseball are going to know this. Something that can happen to a baseball player is they can get what's called the yips. And what the yips is a ball player suddenly loses the ability to do something just incredibly basic to his skill. A catcher may lose confidence in his ability to throw the ball back to the pitcher and just not be able to do it. Or an infielder, one of the famous cases here is Chuck Knoblauch of the Yankees, just lost his confidence after fielding a ball cleanly to make a decent throw to first base. Psychologically, he couldn't do it. So in The Art of Fielding, we have a wonder player who just sort of comes out of nowhere, named Henry Skirmshander, who, even though he's playing at a very dinky and very unusual small school in the Midwest, has this huge error-free streak. bad throw to the first baseman that hits a friend in the dugout and injures him. And Henry develops a terrible case of the yips. So that's kind of, that's one of the basic plots in the very complicated, funny The Art of Fielding, which came out in 2011. And then there's one more book I want to mention, which is The Cactus League by Emily Nims. That book is brand new. I haven't read it yet. But it's a novel of minor league baseball. And for people who enjoy baseball, minor league and college baseball are probably where baseball is. You can afford to get into games. You can get a pretty decent seat. You can really be part of the texture of the game in a way that, that Major League Baseball has kind of passed away from. So those two books, Art of Fielding and The Cactus League, get you there.
Award-winning writer himself, Frank Sos, comes by and recommends some reads now in this time of COVID-19 and the lack of actual games. He's recommending some baseball books. Frank, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Robert.
Links to the books Frank reviewed are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, it's Chris Lott and Catexa Clippings. Welcome back. Here's Chris and Catexa Clippings.
Though Buddhism originated in India nearly 2,500 years ago, it only became a significant religion and philosophy in the Western world in the 1850s. Nevertheless, thanks to its adoption by a large part of the countercultural movement of the 60s, many of the once esoteric key terms in Buddhism and other earlier religions on the Indian subcontinent have become firmly ensconced in everyday English, sometimes with an understanding of their origins and sometimes with no recognition of their connection at all. Take the very word Buddha itself, more properly pronounced Buddha, but it's proving hard to unlearn a lifetime habit. While often understood to be the name of a historical figure, true, or a religious prophet, not so true, the historical Buddha's name was Siddhartha Gautama. Upon his attainment of nirvana, more about that word in a moment, he was given the name Buddha by his followers, a word that in Pali, a classical language of India, literally means awakened or enlightened one. Buddha is derived fittingly from the Proto-Indo-European root bud, to be aware or make aware, from which we've also derived words including Bodhi, perfect knowledge, and also the name of the tree under which Gautama was said to be sitting when he realized his enlightenment, and Bodhisattva, a Steely Dan song, yes, but also another name for Gautama or one who has taken a vow to seek enlightenment for us all, plus more common words such as forbid, foreboding, ombudsman, and verboten. Setting aside some nuances of an ongoing discussion about what the terms really describe, enlightenment is a word often used interchangeably with nirvana or the condition of the Buddha. Nirvana comes from the Sanskrit nirva, to be extinguished, literally to blow out, and appears to have first been used by early Buddhists to describe the state of enlightenment in a rather poetic way, but for reasons that remain obscure. Another Buddhist word that became part of the parlance and common consciousness of English is karma. Though karma is often spoken of as an external force that rewards or punishes us for our actions, or even is synonymous with fate, for Buddhists, this is looking through the wrong end of the telescope. Karma isn't a result of, or a dictating force of actions, but the action itself, or more specifically, the totality of our action and inaction. This fits given that karma is another unchanged borrowing, this time of a Sanskrit word meaning act, action, or performance. The Sanskrit word's root is the Proto-Indo-European quer, to make or to form, another etymology that lends itself to poetry, but in this case one that resonates more strongly because that root quer is also the antecedent of the Greek pteris, or monster, from which we get the word teratology, the study of congenital defects and gross deformations, and the conditions that lead to them. Other words and ideas found in Buddhism, including some that go back even further, have become significantly more disconnected from their traditions. Avatar, an image or other representation of a person in virtual reality, is first seen in a mid-1980s Lucasfilm Studios guide to their virtual world software Habitat, made for the Commodore 64. Avatar was later popularized by Neal Stephenson in his influential, on the geek crowd at least, 1992 novel Snow Crash. And the final push comes from James Cameron's movie of Blue Aliens and Unobtainium, a film boasting the rare double distinction of being both a top five grossing film of all time and one I refuse to watch. Lost in the world's acclaim and my disdain, though, is the fact that Avatar is an idea not just found in Buddhism, but one that goes back to the Sanskrit avatara, to descend, to alight, or to make an appearance, found in earlier Hindu traditions referring to gurus, or more generally, any revered person. Speaking of gurus, that's another Sanskrit word found in Buddhism and Hinduism meaning teacher, but in this case one that goes back another 500 years to the ancient Indian religion of Jainism, where it was used to refer to one who dispels the darkness and takes one toward the light. Finally, a little bit about the most famous living Buddha, the Dalai Lama. Many will know that a Lama is a priest, specifically in Mongolia or Tibet, but did you know that Lama comes to us from the Tibetan word with the same pronunciation, meaning chief, or that the Tibetan word Lama has a silent B at the beginning? I was further surprised to learn, though I shouldn't be, the older I get, the vaster the seas of my own ignorance become apparent, that Dali is a Mongolian word for ocean, or as an adjective, vast or big. So the name Dalai Lama literally means ocean lama, or the teacher possessing the broadest, deepest knowledge possible. For a bit more on other Buddhist words that have become common in English, hitch a ride with your favorite browser heading to katexic.com/KUAC.
That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I hope you're all safe and sound, and until next time, thanks for listening.